sifter.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Lightmap from Sifter. On Lightmap, we have conversations and explore the culture of video games and interactive media with games makers, journalists, and thinkers from around the world. My name is Adam, and thank you for joining me this week. My guest this week is author and journalist Jordan Miner. You may have seen Jordan's writing at Geek.com, his contributions to PC Mag, and his freelance work for gaming outlets including Kotaku, the AV Club, Pace Magazine, and The Escapist. Jordan's latest work is The Video Game of the Year, a year-by-year guide to the best, boldest, and most bizarre games from 1977 to now. Out now through Abrams Books. Much more than a list of 40 games to play, Jordan's book captures the history of the culture and conversation that has shaped itself around video games as an artistic medium, from Pong to Fortnite. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. This is my first international talk about the book. So
yeah, excited to have you on, and really keen to dive into a lot of the themes and just essays that you've put together in here. But before we do that, let's see what's been making the news this week on Walkthrough, which is Sifter's weekly gaming news podcast.
Hi, I'm Kyle Paletto.
And I'm Fiona Bartholomaeus.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, 28th of April.
Embracer is dead. The company will split up into three parts as CEO eats crow after the capitalist implosion reaches a conclusion.
Escape from Tarkov players are up in arms as developers introduce a $250 pay-to-win mode.
Fortnite will let you block those sweaty emotes with strangers that were just a little bit too mean if you want to.
And Fallout 76 hits a massive player milestone after the launch of the TV series.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website sifter.com.au every Sunday.
You're listening to Lightmap, interesting conversations with video game creators.
So, Jordan, I thought we might just start very high level at the top and talk a little bit about you before we dive into the book itself. I'd love to know a little bit about yourself, how you got involved in games writing, and yeah, just a little bit about your career.
Sure. So I always say that I've wanted to write about video games for money since I knew that was a thing that a person could do. That was about like the early 2000s when I started reading more game magazines, before it was E3 2004 was the first E3 I paid attention to, like the DS was coming out. So, you know, that's a long time ago at this point. I started following more gaming news at that point. And then when I was in high school, I started doing a lot of freelance iPhone game reviews because that was a space. There was tons of iPhone games coming out all the time and no one knew which ones were even worth playing. So there was, at the beginning of the App Store, a real demand for freelance iPhone game reviews. So I thought that'd be a kind of a fun way to sort of like get in the trenches of like paying dues or doing game reviews of like, I know I can't come in and start reviewing the big stuff right away. I'm just some kid. But if I can just grind out these like Angry Birds clones and Clash of Clans clones for years and years and just kind of get, you know, just get better at writing, you know, through that as well. So I did that in high school. I was my senior year of high school. I had like two study halls and I would just be in my car playing games and taking notes on them. And that impressed a lot of college interviewers that I was doing that and getting paid for and that I really wanted to do that at that point in my life. And so I went to Northwestern University, which is the Medill School of Journalism, a very good journalism school. So I just learned how to be a kind of all-purpose journalist that way. That was good that they teach you how to do. I was having to cover like city council meetings and stuff I really don't care about at all. But I got to meet a lot of really awesome now, like very serious journalists at places like CNN, like people who were like on the Trump Russia beat at CNN were people I was hanging out with at some of these parties. And I'm just like, I don't want to die in a war. I just want to write about games. I made sure at Northwestern to always try to write about games where I could. So my like capstone project for my magazine writing class was this really in-depth, really reported feature about the Chicago indie game development scene that I then sold to Kotaku. And that was like 10 years ago. That was kind of my big breakout freelance piece. It was like a Kotaku piece about Chicago. Another great thing about that school is that they'd have a residency program where they put people to intern for like a semester. And they put me at PC Mag, and that's where I now work.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about your pathway into the career of games writing, because I think lots of people come in as hobbyist writers or bloggers or what we call now content creators.
Right. Yes.
and it's interesting to hear about a more traditional sort of journalism sort of throughway into talking and writing about games culture. And it mirrors a little bit in my own experience as well, having to go to university and be like, I am learning about writing sports journalism and I do not care about football, but here I am and I need to learn these skills.
They would make us, there was a class where they would make us, you have 3 hours to go interview 20 random people in the city and write a story. And I'm like, okay, this is the worst for my like anxiety and being an introvert, but it was a good way to come out of my shell.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting. How much do you feel like being able to have that sort of like traditional journalism background has really impacted the way that you think about video games and the way that you think about the culture around them as well?
I think it made me less like tolerant of stuff that is bad, if that makes any sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense.
It was my idea of like, if I'm going to, as a kid, I knew like, I'm going to do this game writing thing, but that's ridiculous sounding, you know? So it's like, if I want to do this, I need to be very good at it. Cause if I'm not good at it, then if it doesn't work out for me, then it's like, well, of course it's video game writing. So, yeah, I think it made me really value, I'm not the only person who says this, but like being able to write about, have other interests and be able to write about other things is important for everyone, regardless of what they're doing, I think.
It's like that thing I think about with like cultural criticism, where it's like you need the broad palette of like being able to like consume a whole bunch of books, a whole bunch of film, a whole bunch of cinema, a whole bunch of movies, and take that knowledge into the way that you apply that lens onto video games and vice versa. You need to play a whole bunch of video games to really kind of understand the culture in a broader sense now as well, because they've so enmeshed themselves in the last like 20, 30 years. It's such an interesting place that we find ourselves with games writing now. How do you feel about the current climate of writing about games for a living at this moment in time? We've seen a lot of places shuttering and closing. I know we're going off tangent. We'll get to the book shortly, but it's such an interesting topic to think about, especially in the context of, say, for example, Waypoint and Vice in the last couple of months as well.
Yeah. And I mean, some of it is not the fault of the writers. It's all economics. It's all companies and corporate greed and whatnot. I'm very involved in the union for our company. So I've had a real kind of up close and personal look at how a lot of the forces driving the stuff, like in opposition to just good work happening. A lot of that is very depressing and very much not something I have a lot of solutions for, I guess, in the short term. But there's a lot of talent, but regardless, there's always going to be a lot of talented people. Video games are super popular. There's people who care about them, and a certain percentage of those people are going to be people who want to write about them. So whether it's on these websites or on Future or like on social, like on streaming or other platforms or wherever, they have to get it out there. I think they will get it out there. It's just a matter of, are they going to get like, will it only be like a hobby for them? Will they be like supported to do it to the best of their ability? I don't know. But I guess to tie it back to the book, something that was really important to me was to, at least in my own network, was to gather this group of really excellent writers that I know and at least provide a platform for them in this kind of one-off instance of something that is also a physical object. You know, I've worked for websites that don't exist anymore, or they exist, but, you know, my stuff got, you know, like past versions of it got kind of wiped out. So I have tons of work that you can't really read anymore that was all online. So it was really cool to me to now have this physical object of all my game opinions that will just always, I mean, you know, it will always exist.
It's interesting you bring that up. I think a lot about websites that have shuttered and you lose this entire like history and archive of cultural criticism about things. It's happened a lot in an Australian context with music writing in particular. So some of the biggest kind of like sort of left field kind of music culture and criticism websites have shut down, been rebought over the years, and you've just lost decades of writing as a result. It's sort of like the Australian equivalent of a Pitchfork shutting down and losing everything that was on there and all the freelancers losing all their pieces. I remember a few specific things happening with games writing internationally as well, where websites would shutter. And yeah, I think the thing that I took away from the book while reading it, is particularly with the guest contributors, was the idea of like providing a platform or a leg up for a lot of voices that don't often get to be platformed and spotlighted as well. I'm really curious about the process that you went behind finding the guest contributors and who you picked out, because there's a really broad variety of interesting people here, from sort of really well-known names from like Austin Walker or Patrick Kleppert, to people like Julie Muncy, whose writing I've been reading for years, to YouTubers like Alex Mukakis, who does the great like sort of Final Fantasy music videos, which I love. His enthusiasm and infectiousness for like games music is really kind of addictive and fun to watch. How did you go about finding those people and approaching them to get involved in the book?
Yeah, so that was always part of the initial pitch, even before we sold the book, the idea that we would try to have this whole collection of people. So that was always there from the beginning. So I was, even as I was writing it, I was trying to figure out who I want to approach and, you know, getting a list going as that was going. But then once, you know, once it was sold and once it was like actually out there, then I started approaching people. Some of them kind of already knew already because they're just like friends of mine. You know, there's a lot of people from PC Mag in the book. But yeah, just people that I've admired from just, again, like, you know, like 20 years of being a games writer and following other games writers, and people who I kind of more like up and coming people, and people who seemed like they might be approachable, people who had like open Twitter DMs. So it was really just kind of like a free for all. I was like, if they seem cool, there's no harm in asking them, and they say no, whatever, I'll ask somebody else. So, and then a lot of them said yes.
So let's talk about the genesis of the book itself, because it's sort of like history as a list in a way. And it's I also like to think of it as almost like a Trojan horse. It's like, you can be like, here's my listicle, here's the 40 games, but really it's more than the 40 games I've selected. How did you get there with the idea of, I want to do a video game a year? How did that process start?
Yeah, so the point was to always make it a history book. And the whole list conceit was my way, and other ways, I didn't come up with this, but like, it was a way of making it more like episodic and more like digestible. You could read each chapter as like a big review almost. So it was a way to sort of make it easier for people like who don't know anything about games at all, of like, if you're going to learn the entire history of it, here's a way you can do it sort of step by step. So that was part of the point there. It was also to force interesting decisions, I've been saying. You could put together tons of places that put together their own best games of all times lists. They've tried to make their own game canons, and you can see what those lists are like, and I'll see a lot of the common games that end up on those lists. But limiting myself to one per year, I think, again, like, force a lot of interesting decisions of like, I can only pick one game from 1998, even though that game that year had Ocarina of Time and Metal Gear and Half-Life and StarCraft. And it kept the list from being too dominated by, like, again, like too dominated by games that we've seen a lot of the time in the past. So that was the point. That was the point of having the list.
How did you decide this game is the one that needs to be the one for this year? What were those things that elevated one game from another? Like, what put them into, to quote you, your canon for games?
So there are some games that are just have to be there, like Super Mario Brothers and Pong and Pac-Man and, you know, Minecraft, and there's some stuff that's just obvious that just has to be there. The list was also settled before the bulk of the writing was done too. So that was a way to have like all like the theses settled before I could then really get into the bulk of the writing. But to go back what you were saying about the whole Trojan horse aspect of it, the whole point was to kind of tell the whole history of gaming. So I had to pick games that collectively represented all those different things I wanted to touch on. So a chapter I talk about a lot as maybe one of the more controversial chapters is Spore for 2008. That is not the best game of that year or any year by anyone's measure, but it's very important in what it represents for how games culture can get so wrapped up in hype and impossible expectations and stuff for games that could never deliver on it. And so that's, you know, and we still see that with crowdfunded games and games like No Man's Sky that are now pretty excellent, but launched in not at all the state that people wanted. So that's an important trend to explain about gaming. And I thought that Spore was the best vehicle for explaining it.
I really loved that Spore chapter as well, because Yeah, it was a way not to only kind of lean into like, what is this weird hype cycle thing, this sort of cultural product, but it's also a product of capitalism. And then people get excited for this thing that gets hyper-marketed to them. But also it's a really beautiful way to sort of talk about the wider idea of like sim games as a whole, because, you know, Spore is part of, you know, the SimCity, The Sims, that whole universe as well. So it allows you to almost touch on an entire genre of games itself. And was that something you were thinking of as well when you were kind of picking out these games? Like, this is the one that fits for all these reasons, but also it allows me to expound on, say, a visual novel, for example. Like, Depression Quest is another one of those ones where I feel like it hit a moment of kind of Twine games, Itch games, softer indie games, emotional experience games, but was also about a cultural moment as well that happened.
Yeah, I was absolutely trying to hit as many genres as I could, as many different companies as I could, as many kind of like movements. And to even like, if you, I think you can read it in any order you want, but if you do read it in order, you can start to see kind of narratives emerge. So, you know, if you start with SimCity, which is the 1989 chapter, and then you see that eventually reemerge with Spore. And yeah, I was trying to hit on sort of different, like, in some cases, kind of movements I think are a little underappreciated. So one of my kind of personal picks was Super Meat Boy for 2010. That's a great game in of itself, but also it was my way to talk about Newgrounds and Flash gaming and something that's really been lost, as now just Flash itself has been really purged from the internet. But that was a really secretly influential like part of indie games, I think. And just that whole Flash aesthetic and people kind of playing like really kind of crude browser games on Newgrounds, I think is an important part of gaming history as well.
We talk about Newgrounds turning into like the legitimizing of Newgrounds, if you will, which was when Xbox Arcade opened up and a lot of those games ported over and had a lot of success from there too. And that sort of led to almost kind of like the sort of modern arcadey indie scene that we have in a lot of places now that's all due to Newgrounds. So I love that that was kind of in there as well. When you were thinking about this, were you looking at stories that may have been left out of other places in the past or may have been overlooked in previous attempts to sort of chart the history of video games and its culture?
I will say to that, a lot of the games in there are pretty famous games. I think it's meant to be pretty mainstream. So a lot of picks are like very famous stuff. I will say, though, with the contributors, I left it wide open for them to write about games that I maybe have not heard of, or certainly most audiences have not heard of. So that was my attempt to sort of balance the fact that on the one hand, this kind of needs to talk about famous games for a variety of reasons, but then to have this other angle of it, to sort of have this whole breadth of what games are. But to this extent of kind of platforming like other angles of it, I will say like a lot of game books that I've read that are very good and really well reported, I feel like they focus too much on the games as just as a product or just as like an executive sort of marketing vision. So I feel like a lot of game books in general don't talk about the games enough. So even if I'm talking about a very well-known game, I still feel like me talking about it as a game is a perspective that you may not see in some other books like this. I describe it as my attempt to do a sort of mainstream like arts criticism for video games.
I liked the chapter about Super Mario Brothers because you mentioned about how when we talk about games as culture, because games journalism, games writing, games criticism is such a young medium itself, within the fact that it's in a younger medium that was born within capitalism, we tend to look at other creative mediums as like a milestone that games need to achieve. So that question of what is the Citizen Kane of games tends to loom heavy over things. I like that you answered it in your book with Super Mario, which I think is very brave and bold and a good choice.
Yeah, I mean, that's my take forever. It's also, I just need an angle on Mario that no one had yet. You know, that game's been talked about to death. So like that has to be a chapter, but what can I say about it?
Yeah, but how do you feel about those conversations that we tend to have in game spaces when we are trying to like view them through the lens of something as not a capitalistic product, but then like kind of end up going through these interesting cycles where we might compare them endlessly to cinema, for example?
Yeah, that's tough too. Well, one, that's another consequence of just all these sites getting destroyed. Like all these conversations, a lot of them have been had already. But you can't go to that website anymore. So it gets rehashed again. It's like, oh, our games, what about, should we have scores for game reviews and all this stuff that's been talked about for years and years? So that's a kind of another kind of issue of like the cultural memory not being what it needs to be because we don't have the it doesn't exist in the way that it should.
No, that's a really interesting point. And I think a lot about where we are right now on the internet as a whole. We've got this sort of weird, we're in a weird flash moment. And I don't know how like out of date what I'm about to say is going to be like by next week, but it feels like we are slowly watching very homogenized platforms that a lot of people have been using for long periods, Reddit, Twitter, social media as a whole, start to kind of fragment and fall apart. And I wonder, are we shifting back to a model of an older internet where things were kind of siloed off on lots of different weird websites and lots of internet forums kind of came together? And I think to myself, what is going to happen there to the, I guess, the more kind of broader social conversation that's been happening online for the last 15 years about games? And is it necessarily a bad thing that we are moving back towards a place that might be like an older internet as opposed to where we've been over the last 15 years?
I've thought about this a lot, and I think that some people really welcome that, and I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but my skepticism about that is, will that appeal to people? Will that only appeal to people who even have that experience but with how the internet used to be? Like, the internet changing to what it was, or kind of it still is now, allowed a lot more people to get on it and to interact with it in like a meaningful way. So like, will those people, will all your like Facebook family like go on a forum? Like, no. And I still think that there's value in having places on the internet that there are like places where like everyone is. I think if that goes away, I think something important is kind of lost in that.
I think you also touched on a really good point about like preservation of like history and cultural conversation, which I think this book does a lot of like heavy lifting to sort of do. What are some of the things in this book that you were like, this needs to be in here, it needs to be preserved in a physical format, I don't want this thing wiped off the internet, I feel like we need to have the definitive version of what happens here in this book?
So I don't know how mainstream yet Jerry Lawson's whole story is to most people. I feel like at this point it's very common knowledge, but I think my perspective is really different as both a hardcore gamer and as a Black person that, oh, of course, who doesn't know Jerry Lawson? But to put that in this book in like the first chapter, to just tell people, hey, cartridges, this really foundational piece of game tech was invented by this Black guy, was something that was very important to me to put in the book for sure. And you know, going more on the preservation angle, if you want to play most of the games in here, like now legally, like how could you for most of them? So if you can't play it, at least you can read about it, I guess.
Yeah. It's like some of these games are in museums now, thankfully. A whole bunch of them you just can't get. It's an interesting thing to feel like the writing and the conversations that you're having about these things disappear and recycle themselves, but then the things themselves become inaccessible in a way that feels very frustrating too.
Yeah, I mean, at PC Mag, I cover a lot of streaming services as well. I review like Netflix and places like that, and all their content libraries are also now getting wiped every other month. So it's not just games; it's all art.
Yeah, it's almost like the end point of where capitalism takes art in a way, which is that the art itself is less valuable for capitalism. Therefore, it doesn't have to be permanent and we don't need to preserve it. We just need to give you the next thing.
Right. And the streaming services didn't even make money. Like, they weren't even good at that part of it.
Let's jump back to the book for a second. I really loved your approach to kind of writing these beautiful essay chapters for each particular game. But one thing that I also really loved was at the end of each chapter, you had a little column called Extra Life, which I think was an acknowledgement that there is just so much to cover here that even if I pick one thing a year, there's other stuff that needs to come in as well. And I loved that there was a little side essay of another game from that year. And then that's how you also branched in a lot of the guest contributors in as well, by finding a thematic link to that year's game and kind of linking other games to it as well. How did that column come to life in this book? And was there an equally agonizing sort of process of deciding what was going to be in there as well?
Yeah. So yeah, that was, I had way too many games I wanted to talk about. And I wanted to get as many games in the book as I could. I wanted to be as comprehensive and sort of definitive as I could get it. So just have these runner-ups was my way of doing that. And it's kind of just as a reading experience, it sort of mix it up too. It's like you read this whole long chapter. Now here's like a little short thing. Kind of make it more like a magazine, I guess, in a sense. And yeah, it was just cool to have stuff like to see other. It kind of gave you a more of a context of that whole year to see what was another important thing coming out that year. Like, oh, this also like you may not, you might realize that something also was coming out around the same time. And it could be in, like in conversation with that game. In some kind of way. So to see like Call of Duty 4 in 2007 and then Far Cry 2 in 2008, I was like, oh wow, like that's a real leap even from just that 1 year.
Because it's when we're writing about the history of games, there's so many giant leaps that happen in such a short period of time. And I really love how your book actually captures that feeling of how fast things were moving in such a short period of time, so much in such a radically short period of time. It's like, where will Animal Crossing be in 5 years' time? We don't know, but we know right now in this moment, it was a huge part of 2020 for so many people. And for a lot of people, their entry point into video games as a whole, because that was what got them through the pandemic, was finding that game.
Right. And the pandemic is, you know, is obviously a pretty like immediately important historical event, like not that far removed from it. So that was a pretty easy one to sort of predict. But yeah, like besides that, yeah, you're right. It's time to like guess what wound up being important.
Yeah, when I think about that idea of slowdown that I mentioned, it's almost that sort of like I can pick up a game from 8 years ago and it kind of looks and feels not too different to what I'm playing now. Like, yeah, hair might be looking a bit better. There's some ray tracing going on, but for the most part, I feel like I can pick up like a Red Dead Redemption 2, for example, and then, you know, a Star Wars Jedi Survivor, which came out a couple months ago, and the through point between those two games is very close now. But when we go back a couple of decades in your book to the mid 80s, a 5 year difference in games is almost like a radical shift in the entire way that you interface with the game, the controller that you use, everything that's happening on screen, an entire technology for how you create graphics may have shifted. It's so interesting how you manage to capture that kind of really like hyper fast period of just games evolving and shifting and changing so dramatically.
I mean, that's just the reality of what was happening. I didn't really, you know, it was all just sort of presented to me. It also kind of led to a slowdown in the writing by the end too, because I wrote it front to back, like beginning to end. And so in the beginning, when stuff was always so different, every single chapter, it's like, oh, okay, there's a lot of momentum to try the next thing. And then I was getting towards the end, I was just kind of tired in general. I'd written like a whole book at that point, but then it's like, okay, these new ones. What is the combination of I'm just tired, they're not that different, and I don't know how important this will be. So, but you know, I'm proud of all the chapters.
One chapter that I feel I thought is extremely important, and I'm really glad that's in here, is you know, I think one that goes to the heart of a lot of cultural conversations we've had over the last 10 years in sort of the game space, particularly around the idea of like, and I hate this term, but like, who is the gamer? And like, who gets to talk about games? What games are valued? And I feel like you really unpacked that really well in the chapter on 2014 about Depression Quest, which was Zoe Quinn's game about experiencing depression and going through life, which then blew up into a hate movement that kind of overtook games culture for an extended period of time. I would argue is still there bubbling away, called Gamergate. Tell me a bit about that chapter and a bit about the process of why it was really important to articulate clearly what was happening in that point in time.
Yeah. So that was always going to be in the book. There was no pushback. There was no, like, that was always the plan, partially because that's something that a lot of people who don't know games have at least vaguely heard about. So that kind of is in keeping with it being something for like mainstream readers. It was important for me to talk about that because it was an unavoidable thing it just happened. Like, it would be disingenuous to not talk about it. If you're going to talk about the history of gaming, like, of course. And you know, it was important for me to, I love video games, but it was important for me to not be like just completely fawning over them. That's also dishonest. that would just be not true. That would not reflect. If the goal was to put all of my takes on games in this book, I need to put all of them in there. And that's not the only critical take, but that's like a, you know, that's one of the bigger ones, certainly. I'm a very political person. I didn't feel the need to adopt some, like, you know, fake kind of centrist standpoint for something that I very much have an opinion on in this instance. And then it was important for me in that chapter to segment it, having the back half be about the sort of political stuff, but to have the first part be just about the game, just to talk about the game on its own merits. Like you said, to have a visual novel kind of text adventure game in there, to represent another just genre, and to represent another indie game, and to talk about, like, the creator of an indie game, you know, something I tried to do in all the chapters where I could was mention the names of individual people where I could, you know, games are made by huge teams, but at least to put some sort of human face to it. So, you know, that was one that was really important for a variety of reasons. And I hope people like how it turned out.
Yeah. And I think as well, those are the chapters that resonate the most. It's the spore chapter, for example, that, like, you mentioned before, it's like, those are the important conversations that we think about with games a lot that don't get to happen a lot in this field, because, as you said, we've had those conversations before, but then they disappear off the internet in a lot of ways. And being able to step aside and actually critique something you love, I think, is a really important thing. And also just kind of present the history of something that you love as well, authentically and earnestly as well, I think is really important too. And so it's good to be able to highlight something, put a light on Spore and be like, actually, that game kind of sucked, but we were really excited because it sounded like the most amazing thing in the world. Here's what it feels like to get sucked into something that feels like it was going to be the most amazing thing in the world. But I guess you made a worm that climbed out of the water. So, you know, it's the same thing with Gamergate as well. That period sucked. It was not great. It was fascinating to see how that movement and culture on the internet then shifted into what people think of as modern day Trumpism and trolling on the internet, and to kind of see that, like, the early nascent form of that evolve over time within a community that, like, you enjoy is kind of a depressing and disappointing thing, but it's part of the history of games culture and it kind of has to be acknowledged. So I think it's great that it's in this book. And I think also it's great that the actual game itself, which is quite good and has a lot of merits behind it, and I think is a really beautiful piece of art about exploring depression and mental health, gets to have its moment as well, separate to the movement that kind of appeared around it as well. I think if anyone picks up this book, that's a great chapter to jump into and to dive into for a good understanding of games culture.
And then it only gets less depressing from there. So
yeah, every other chapter is great and full of good things, amazing achievements, great things people have made and done.
That's very, I appreciate that though. Yeah, because that was one that was definitely, it's like, I hope this one's received well, because it's a spicy one.
I wanted to ask you a couple of, you know, quick fire questions.
Sure.
Favorite chapter? Which is the one that you were like, I'm so glad I got this one in?
So the Stanley Parable chapter was a late edition. That was after the bulk of the writing was done in 2021. But then we were like, we should get as far as we can. The book's coming out this year, so we should get as far as we can. So, and I don't like Souls games, as people will read in the book, so I wasn't going to pick Elden Ring.
My editor is going to be so happy, by the way. I'm the only one on the team that likes them.
Well, I hope you still appreciate the Sekiro chapter. It's not,
I do.
So it wasn't going to be Elden Ring. If I'd written it, Immortality, I hadn't played Immortality yet. But also, I'll talk about her story in the Dragon's Lair chapter, so that's okay. But Stanley Parable Ultra Deluxe just comes out. I am in love with it. That's another kind of cheat, because it lets me talk about a game that's pretty old still. Like, we can talk about the previous versions of that game, so we have some history with that. But that game as, like, a deluxe version, and the way it complicates notions of, like, what is a sequel versus a remake versus a remaster versus just the idea of extra content is very much, like, on that game's mind. So being able to talk about that kind of at the last minute was really cool. And just to have the chapter end with talking about, like, games are about choice, but what about a game about that? What about to have it end with a game about games thought was a pretty kind of cool, like, full circle moment.
And on that moment, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us, Jordan.
Thanks for having me on.
Video Game of the Year is out now through Abrams Books. You can pick it up at good bookstores or online.
Australia's best video game podcast.
This is Lightmap. Get every episode free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and sifter.com.au.
That's all for today's show. Thanks again for Jordan Miner for joining us on the program. Sifter is produced by Fiona Bartholomeus, Daniel Lang, Chris Button, and Adam Christou. Mitch Lowe is our senior producer, and Gianni Di Giovanni is our executive producer. You can find links to everything we talked about on our website, which is sifter.com.au. Read more about the games and guests that we've featured there. Why not join the Sifter community? If you enjoyed this and you enjoyed listening to the podcast, you can join us on our Discord server or at sifter.com.au/Discord. Please share this show. It's the number one thing that you can do to help support us. Word of mouth is really important for indie podcasts like us. So let your friends know. And if you reckon they'll enjoy it, send them a link. That's all for now. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you on the next episode of Lightmap.
Hi, Chris Button here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Unicorn Overlord might have a strange name, but don't dismiss its tactical prowess.
It uses a tactics mode, which is similar to the Gambit system that was in Final Fantasy XII for your squad mates. And you can say, okay, well, you know, Hodrick, who's my legionnaire with the big shield, I want him to prioritize protecting the back row. They're going to take the most damage. If they take a physical hit, they're going to go down, but I need them to be protected. So you can get quite granular with this, and I reckon you could build some pretty wild builds that are totally game-breaking, but it's kind of the fun of the tactical squad-based gameplay in Unicorn Overlord.
Tune in to Drop Rate to find out why Unicorn Overlord might just be one of 2024's sleeper hits. Available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.